Hello and good afternoon, everyone. It's Paul D'Souza and Warren Giroux from Sightline Wealth Management here for another weekly conversation. And it is July 9th, 2020. Very hot in Ontario and really enjoying the weather. Warren, how is it in New Brunswick?
That's great. Actually, this morning it started out on the cool side around 20 degrees Celsius, but since then it's warmed up quite nicely.
Lovely.
It's around the high 20s.
Well, speaking of the nice weather, as you and I discussed back in March, as the nice weather would occur, you could keep people in their homes and they're out, and we're seeing a second wave and a spike in cases, especially in the United States. So maybe let's begin there.
Well, I think that was expected, that when people started coming outside, that you would certainly see a spike in cases. I guess one of the things that we'd heard early on, points to consider, was we heard that with warmer weather, the virus would die. But apparently that's true when it lands on a surface. The sun will kill the virus when it lands on a surface. But still, it's still very contagious as far as human-to-human contact. And that's one thing that I guess maybe that we weren't really sure of, but seems to be proving out to be the case now. Yeah. With a lot of people going to restaurants and the patios, outdoor patios, and you can still contact the disease by being outside, because obviously there's, even if you're fairly close, it's quite possible to pick up the virus. So, the spike has been pretty dramatic, particularly in states like Texas and Florida. I'm watching the death rate to see what's happening there. Their death rate so far to date is still under the average, but I would expect it's going to pick up. So that will take a few weeks before we actually will know what's going on there.
I'm looking at a chart with the world's worst outbreaks, the places with the most new coronavirus cases per million in the last 7 days. Arizona with 3,300. Florida, South Carolina, Bahrain, Louisiana, Qatar, Oman. So we have literally, and the U.S. states take up the rest of the next 15 spots worldwide. It's astounding.
It is. It is really, when you think about it. It certainly is the gift that keeps on giving. It just won't go away.
And with this too now, so the intensive care units are now at full capacity in some of these states. So I think this is what was worried. This was the major worry back in March, and now we're seeing it. So let's see how this plays out in terms of ventilators and just being able to get into that intensive care unit.
Sorry, I was going to say, one of the things that I think we have learned is that the use of ventilators is sort of the last ditch effort or sort of protocol, because ventilators were responsible for, or from what I read anyway, that they were responsible for quite a few of the deaths originally. Ventilation is the absolute last procedure they want to commit to.
Right. And maybe changing gears here, I know that you follow the unemployment stats each week. What happened this week?
This week, again, it was a decrease. We had 1.31 million filed for new benefits for the week ending July the 4th. That was down from the previous week of 1.41. And if we remember back in March, the number originally was 7 million per week, and that's certainly come down a lot. But the layoffs are still concerning. And the continuing claims for the week ending June the 20th rose from 30 million to 32.9 million. So that's still very, very worrisome. There's been talk that we've regained about 7.5 million jobs have been regained in May and June, which was sort of a promising number. But here we are with reversing and rolling back some of the lockdown reopenings. And so we're back into lockdown mode in some respects. And so we'll have to wait and see what the numbers are in the next few weeks. But it's still, it's not a great number. It's encouraging to see that, there is some job creation, but it's certainly going to slow now with the sort of suspension of the reopenings going on.
Stock buybacks are seen as a bullish indicator. And in the last, let's see, for June, it was the lowest amount of stock buybacks since May 2009. And I think, you know, on the surface, you can see that as negative. However, you and I were talking earlier, that's actually probably not such a negative. Yeah, do you want to share what your thoughts were on that?
Well, I was just thinking that a lot of companies are probably trying to preserve cash. And they went out, you know, a year, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, we always talked about stock buybacks and how that was influencing the market, pushing valuations up to extended levels. And now they're sort of in survival mode. And so they actually are trying to preserve cash by not doing the stock buyback. So I look at that as a good thing. And of course, you know, we've seen dividends cuts. We don't see that many dividend increases anymore. So I think that's another indication that they're in survival mode.
Yeah, good point. Now, with the Fed signaling that there's going to be low rates for at least another year, possibly two, we've also discussed the possibility to go negative. I think that will happen, but not until maybe after that. Sometimes I think it's being optimistic in terms of thinking we'll get out of this crisis and without having the need to go negative. And that is, I mean, there's so many variables and factors as a result of low rates that impact investors. It's a war on investors. It's a war on savers. And it forces investors to actually avoid bonds because of extremely low yields and push them into risky assets, such as stocks, at a time when they're most overvalued. So it's a very precarious time. And the need for income amongst retirees is, with the aging population and the boomer demographic at a very high level. So there's a perfect storm here facing individuals who are retired. They can't afford to take losses. They need income. Risky stocks, low interest rates, really, really needs a professional here to help navigate these very precarious waters here. Any comments on that?
Yeah, well, I think you and I've talked about this, is that it's, we've been big fans of alternative investing, alternative private debt. And private debt has actually done very, very well. It's been maintaining, anywhere from 6 to 8, 9, 10% returns, which obviously a lot of investors need or retirees need for income. But you have to be very careful in that sector because, you have to know what the portfolio is doing. And that's one of the things that we watch as close as we possibly can to see, how or who they're lending to. You hope they're lending to people where their businesses are required or necessary. And there are many businesses out there that are actually booming right now with this COVID crisis and this COVID economy. And so those sectors are the sectors you hope your managers are lending to. So we're very mindful of that. There's going to be many, many businesses that are going bankrupt. I mean, you've seen the numbers and you and I've discussed it where we've seen, there's a possibility that you could see 20 or 30% of the small businesses go belly up. And sir, that's very disconcerting. So in as much as the alternative of private investment or private debt has been a great source of revenue, you have to be very, very careful and very mindful of that situation. And to your other point regarding the savers, yes, it's very devastating. And we've seen what's happened with zero interest rates in Europe. And also Japan, we think about Japan. I mean, they've had zero interest rates for, almost, going on a decade as well. And it's really been devastating to the savers, and especially people who have to live on fixed income. And the other thing that people don't think about is that a lot of our defined benefit pension plans that are unions and so forth and so on, and cities and municipalities and our government pension plans and bureaucrats are all defined benefit pension plans. And quite often they're mandated to have, 30, 40, 50% of their asset allocation to fixed income. And by and large, they're investing in high quality securities, but the rate, the coupons on those bonds are, very, very low. And, today with the 30-year bond, it, next to nothing, and even a 10-year bond, one and a half, it's US, that is, there's no return there. So it's forcing people to go into alternative investments and real estate. A lot of the pension plans invested heavily in real estate, commercial real estate. So as you and I discussed as well, commercial real estate could be in trouble because look at all the malls, look at all the retail, bricks and mortar. They're going to be suffering. Office space. There's a few good segments in that area, like residential, apartment rentals, that sort of thing, hospitals, and so forth, healthcare facilities. But, you know, again, have to be selective. Have to be selective.
That's a key word. I mean, investors can't look at, oh, this is a private debt investment and allocate to it. It's such a specialized asset class that requires a lot of experience and expertise in doing the due diligence, the monitoring, and the continued oversight. It's not a set and forget investment.
No, not at all.
Having oversight on the types of loans, the leverage, if there's any leverage used, how much, the quality of the underlying assets. You know, the challenges in this space is, you know, it can be illiquid. Transparency is a challenge. There's limited information on the record of some of these asset classes. And so you need a strong team in order to do that. And of course, we tend to focus, or I think solely focus on, in the capital stack is the senior debt. So we're comforted that there's assets backing loans and that the underwriting was done very well, so that in case of a default, then we can recoup the investment.
Yeah, one of the other things they do on a continuous basis, and we talking to our managers, they're continually looking at their collateral package to make sure there's the value of that collateral package is being maintained in the event that there's a default. So yeah, again, the monitoring right now is critical and crucial in these types of investments. Just sort of changing the subject, if I may, we were talking earlier about financial repression, and I know you had some thoughts on that and have been doing some reading on it, and wondering what your thoughts were there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, financial repression, that's something I've been studying and reading for about 10 years now. In 2011, the IMF published a working paper. It was written by Harvard economists, I think Rogoff and Reinhardt, and they strongly suggested that financial repression be implemented to eliminate the massive debt from sovereign nations. And it's not a new policy. It was used in 1945 to 1975. And debt to GDP levels at that time were 90%. And that policy was extremely effective as the debt levels dropped by 70% over the next 25 years. And so if you look at all the sovereign nations, the debt to GDP levels are extremely high. And so that policy has actually been implemented. And it's a very stealth policy. And it's a war on savers. It's a war on investors. And it uses four key tools. And number one is you have to keep interest rates low. And we have that. You keep inflation higher than interest rates. And that's another side subject for us. Third, you have to mandate the institutions hold only government debt or large amounts of government debt. So in the investment policy statements, they can only hold government debt, so that finances the deficits. And lastly, capital controls in the U.S. And so the IRS, and with their FACTA laws, are now searching worldwide for any American citizens in terms of bringing taxes back home and preventing the movement of money as well. So that's keeping all the money within the U.S. So we have those four tools firmly in place. And what it does is, alluding to kind of what we discussed earlier, it forces risky decisions to be made by these savers and investors because of financial repression. And it's this hidden stealth destruction of wealth because inflation is higher than what the interest rate is on bonds. And so we can debate, is inflation higher or not higher? So in some instances, it seems like it's lower, but in many it is higher. And just I saw at the grocery store the other day, three pieces of steak, I forget what cut it was, that I typically get was almost $57. and that seemed to maybe jump. I have to check the prices here by at least 25% for the last little while. And so for some of our listeners who, you know, there's some individuals out there who've tracked what official inflation stats are versus the way that it used to be calculated, there's a large disconnect. Current official inflation rate's at 0%. However, the method to calculate that's been changed in a drastic way over the last number of years. So, but if you take the calculation, say 1990, before it was changed, and use that methodology, inflation rate today is 4%. And that kind of seems about right intuitively, if you ask individuals. I was at, a few years ago, I remember being in line, and there's these women in front of me, and they were buying boxed muffins or cake mix. And they were complaining to each other, and I'm overhearing them, that the box used to yield 12 muffins, and now it yields 9. And so, but the price was kept the same. And this is just one such way that that the inflation calculation has been substituted or changed to make it look like there's no inflation, because the same box of muffins is now the same price. However, the yield is 30% less.
Oh, I was going to say they do the same thing in with automobiles in a way, because what they do is they say they bring on enhancements. A new car has all the technology and so forth that old cars obviously did not have because it wasn't available. And they say the price of cars haven't really gone up that much because it's being adjusted to reflect the changes in safety, the technologies being used in the car with the GPS and all this sort of nonsense. So it's inflation
we're interrupting each other, excuse me. That term is called hedonic adjustments.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
And it's also used same with technology and computers. So if you buy a computer that has, you know, a processor that's twice as fast as the previous model, same price, it'll assume that you're 50% 100% more effective. Therefore, you can get more done in the day. Therefore, there is no inflation.
Yeah. I think one of the fears that, I think there's two kinds of inflation. There's demand inflation and there's supply inflation. And I think what we're running in this case of food is more of a supply inflation, where we've had a lot of the food sectors have been shut down because of COVID. And as a result, we're having a shortage of supply in certain items and certain food stuff. So I think, I read somewhere here a while ago that as a result of COVID, that there's probably going to be the starvation rate globally is going to go up dramatically. Again, it boils down to the ability to actually produce food and distribute food. And those nations that are most impacted are, of course, the poorest nations. And the number was something like 1.1 billion people are on the edge of starvation as a result of COVID. But, our experts, our scientists that shut down the economy or forced the politicians or recommended to politicians, we shut down the economy. They're not looking at that calculation. They're not looking at the damage that's being done globally. Just so that, I understand we don't want to get sick, but there would certainly have to be a better way to do it than what they've done, because the devastation is very, very traumatic. And it's, in the West it's bad enough, but you can imagine in the third world. It's just it's unbelievable. But we can debate that all day long.
Oh, we certainly can, yeah. So when you look at these low rates and then due to financial repression, reading Ray Dalio, he writes a good point. He says, to make a reasonably accurate projection of the future, you ask yourself, who will the central bank need to help most? And you figure out what they're likely to do given the tools they have at their disposal. And then by looking at this, you can get an idea of the monetary policy shifts, which are the main driver of the paradigm shifts. And he continues, so to me, this is Ray Dalio speaking, it seems obvious that they have to help the debtors relative to the creditors. So at the same time, the law of diminishing returns will have, because you can only lower rates so low, and then there's no further stimulus available there. You just have to pump more money into the economy. Further, he says, it's highly likely that sometime in the next few years, central banks will run out of stimulant to boost the markets and the economy when the economy is weak. And interest rates would push so low that investors holding the debt won't want to hold it any longer, and then start to move something to something that they think is better. And as you know, and investors know, the market moves in massive waves and shifts. And so we're at the tail end of this massive long, since 1980, in terms of what interest rates were at, what was it back then, Warren?
14, 15%. Yeah, 14%. I mean, it is insane.
And right back now down close to zero. So this is the end. And there's going to be a fundamental massive shift.
Well,
so investors have to, yeah, go ahead.
You know, I was going to say that's true. But back to what one of your repression arguments is, the government mandates you have to buy bonds. You know, there was talk when Obama was president that he was going to create some sort of a special fund, but you had to buy government securities, had to buy government bonds. And this is what you're talking about is what Martin Armstrong refers to as a shift from public to private. So and this comes in waves, and it comes in, you know, cycles. And we're at the tail end of sort of the public wave, where people believed in sovereign debt and, you know, basically had a major part of their investment in the public debt. And this is going to shift to private, where people are going to dump the sovereign debt because interest rates are so low, and invest in other types of investments, maybe equities, corporate bonds, because they're not tied to government, real estate, what have you. But it will be a massive shift away from government debt. And when that happens, there'll be more, you know, regulations involved. And, you know, don't forget, it wasn't that long ago in this country alone, in Canada, that a pension plan was mandated to have no more than 10% in foreign securities. It wasn't that long ago. And so that was forcing pension plans to invest in Canada. And, you know, that regulation was repealed. Don't be surprised to see that come back. I mean, it wasn't that long ago in the UK, I think it was UK. Anyway, it doesn't really matter, where pension plans were mandated to have so much in fixed income. So, you know, what you're talking about, financial repression that we saw back in the late 40s and 50s, it's not hard to believe. I mean, that sounds like a long time ago, but for me, it wasn't that long ago. I remember some of this stuff. And the advantage they had back then, of course, was the growth rate was just unbelievable, because we were trying to recover from a world war. And so that's the advantage we had back then, and they were able to get away with it and actually pay down debt. But we don't have that growth anymore. We're not recovering from a world war. And growth rates that actually virtually disappeared in Europe and in Japan and parts of Asia, certain, you know, in Japan anyway. Other parts of Asia and emerging market parts, of course, they had great growth rates. And I think, you know, we've seen many recommendations regarding emerging market debt and emerging market equity markets. I think that's based on the fact that they're still developing. Whereas the West has matured. You know, we're sort of in the fall season of our cycle. And so we're in a different situation than, say, an emerging market is, or an emerging economy is, where they have a young population, a growing population. So. Paul, you're on mute.
Excuse me. Yeah, sorry to interrupt back there. I just recalled the time back as an advisor in the late 90s. And it was very, each month we would have a report showing our foreign content limit in RSPs. And if there was a penalty, if investors were, I'm going back now, was it over 20%, I think, was the maximum of foreign content rule. And
exactly.
So, oh my, yeah, boy, you brought me way back. So on financial repression too, in terms of, and this, with these low rates, if you think of the overall risk that this manifests now is money managers are now seeking to have a positive return on their capital. So with low rates, they now have to take on higher risk to obtain these higher yields. Now, the problem is that with many investments, the risks are asymmetrical. You're not getting paid enough for the risk you're taking on. And so it's not uneven. So investors are unknowingly taking a higher risk in order to earn that lower yield. Even it could be even 3 or 4%. The risk is really not commensurate with it. And then now, in order to raise capital now, these lenders are now forced to lend to marginal borrowers who typically would not qualify for loans in more prudent times. And so these, if they don't, now the lenders are now foregoing income. So there's that delicate balance of investing only with those who are willing to say no, willing to turn down or not make any money rather than invest with marginal borrowers. And then with these low rates, with higher inflation, savings is now being destroyed just through the low rates again and the inflation on it. All circling back to our original point, it's a war on savers and investors, and going back to our private debt, which is working out quite well with the senior security and the higher yields. And it's been very solid.
Yeah, it has. One other comment that I wanted to mention there, we were talking about inflation and so forth, is that remember that study I think I showed you a couple of weeks ago, and it said with interest rates, central banks, monetary policy goes below 4%, there's a disincentive to actually spend money. And the saving rates goes up exponentially. And I think to a certain extent, we've seen that in Japan, we've seen it in Europe, where, you know, savers or people who are thinking about retiring realize they need more money to retire. So there's also a deflationary cross current in there. In as much as we're having inflation in food, we're having inflation in various other items like housing and rents and so forth. Also, I think the big thing that we don't really talk about much is, I think we're going to see our tax bill go up exponentially, property taxes as well as income taxes. And that's not in the calculation, the inflation calculation, I don't believe. So I would expect over the next couple of years to see that, you know, go up exponentially. And that becomes another drag on the economy for growth and the ability of government just to pay down debt. I think you need growing economy where you have GDP growing at 4 and 5% before you can actually expect to have tax revenues actually go up to the point where they can pay down debt.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a double-edged sword. We've got ourselves in a real fix here.
I think it's worth repeating what we discussed our last call is the capital gains inclusion rate likely going to rise. And oh boy, if the principal residence exemption is removed, look out, there's going to be some very angry Canadians. I mean, it is in the United States, right now you cannot write off interest on your mortgage. And so I would hope if that's even discussed, that that's at least tabled to make it somewhat fair.
Yeah, I would like to think so. I know in the U.S. you can write off your interest, but you can also, your capital gains on your house is okay as long as you reinvest in another property.
Right.
Your kids can't pull it out. But there's got to be some real thoughtful exchange of ideas, I think, and considerations when they come forward with whatever new regulations and taxes and so forth they come up with. Because, you know, the economy hasn't really been growing by that much in the first place. And, you know, what David Rosenberg says in a podcast here not long ago, I thought it was really, I thought it was great. You know, a recession, you forget, behavior doesn't change. And within 6 months to a year, you forget about it. In a depression, your behavior changes. And I think we have been in a depression, whether you can say a depression economically or not, but you have in a depression, you change behavior. And we have been in one, I believe, because of the changes in behavior. I know people who are not willing to go back to work in a normal office environment. simply because they're afraid. People who don't go shopping or out to restaurants because they're afraid. But then again, my generation is the older generation, and we're more likely to be afraid. Whereas the younger generation, who are, you know, I think most responsible for the spike in COVID cases, of course they're going to go out. Yeah, when you have a behavioral change like we've just seen and just witnessed, that stays for quite a long time and causes, again, further pressure on the economy.
No, it does. I remember early in my career, I had some clients that were quite elderly, and they were part of the Great Depression, and that imprinted upon them a set of investing beliefs that you could never change. They were just so conservative, unwilling to take on any risk, and that lasted a lifetime for them. They lived some horrible lean times, and so perhaps this may be somewhat similar to that.
I think so.
I think everyone walks around thinking it'll never happen here, that happens somewhere else, and I think it just proved that this is not something that just happens in some third world country.
Yeah. I have to ask you, Paul, every once in a while I ask you about gold.
Oh, I know.
Recently
this was
seen
coming.
Yeah, we've seen gold go, you know, up quite nicely. I don't know where it peaked recently. I'm just going to check on a chart right now. I think
1826, I think.
I was going to say 1820. Well, actually, it's down $12 today. So that meant it was up at least to 1820 earlier today when we started the day. And yeah, here's a chart here. It was 1825, 1826, somewhere in that neighborhood. And recently, it just fell back about $12. And, you know, what's really interesting is a lot of those people you're talking about, the older generation from the Depression, they have been investors in gold as a monetary as well as an investment, a way to ensure a sort of protection against a monetary crisis. So, but I was just wondering if you had any recent thoughts on gold and what you're seeing in the gold market.
Look, it's approaching the highs of 2011. So I think that'll be quite a strong resistance there. Investors don't own any gold whatsoever now, I think. Think of that allocation that you want to be at and start with one third. And, you know, a recent commentary and some analysis that we look at, I think anything below 1770, there could be some weakness there. So if it falls below 1770, then you may want to wait a bit, you know, pick up the other third of your position. But it is a staple in a portfolio. I don't know how else to explain it other than you hold it. Actually, first of all, make sure if you're owning gold, that you actually own gold and not a proxy for gold, not a derivative, not a certificate, not a claim on it. When you add up all of the claims on gold around the world from every investor that thinks they own an ounce of gold, a large amount of that is not actually held by that. That has been an artificial suppression of the price of gold, because if you would think if every investor, if you flip that around, everyone who thinks they own gold would actually go out and buy actual gold, the price would have a massive revaluation upwards. There's an individual, I can't remember his name, he referred to as the price of gold or the gold price. And so the price of gold is physical. The gold price is some proxy derivative. So now, if someone is just simply speculating, doesn't care if they owned it or not, then that's fine. Just own whatever proxy you like for the wealth preservation attributes of it as a monetary asset. That's sort of the asset of last resort, one with a several thousand year history. You must own it. And, you know, so there's a few quality companies out in Canada that actually store gold. They're serial numbered. They're placed in the mint. And they're 100% allocated. They're not encumbered. There's no one else's liability, and they're not triple counted, or there's not multiple owners on the same bars. So those are all very important attributes. And then I actually want to own it with a. This is how I look at it personally. You own it, and you hope you never have to sell it, and you want to pass it down to your children. I think that was Pierre Lassonde who actually wrote that years ago. And so that kind of stuck with me. He owns gold to hope he never has to sell it. They pass it down to his children. And so when it's in a portfolio, I honestly don't fuss about it. I'm happy I own it. The price is going to bounce around. As we know, there's a lot of Scotia and a bunch of other JP Morgan has been charged with gold price manipulation. Silver's been manipulated. It doesn't bother me. It bothers me if I actually own it. And then the price will be the price, and things will take a lot longer than one expects to play out. I think many people in buying gold were hoping for the super spike and to become rich. I look at it differently. I look at it, I want to preserve my purchasing power. And so I want to be able, I think actually Eric Sprott said this, if a cup of coffee costs $1,000, and you know, I want to be able, so how do you phrase it? I want to be able to buy a cup of coffee today and in the future. If it costs $1,000, I want to be able to buy it, you know, with the same ounces of gold.
Yeah.
Right. So
what I find interesting is you mentioned gold is nearing its top back in 2011. I think it was 2011 that it hit its top. Silver, on the other hand, is not. Silver is substantially below where it was then. And I guess there's a couple things. One, it's an institutional metal. I think that's the primary, and people don't think of silver quite the same way they do gold. Silver is trading around about $19. What's interesting, if you listen to some of the podcasts that are done by Sprott Resources or whatever.
Yes.
There's a lot of leverage in a lot of these gold companies, these gold producers that have been, you know, their cost of production is, you know, maybe $1,100 an ounce. And all of a sudden we're seeing this move in gold. When they report their earnings for the quarter, they're going to see a huge spike in earnings because their fixed costs are fairly tight. They've been survivors. And now all of a sudden, when you increase the price of gold by $1 or $2 or $100 or $200 an ounce, that just hits right on the bottom line.
Right.
So at some point here, we should see a real big spike in some of the precious metals companies. But again, they're more volatile, and they're, you know, they have management issues, they have debt issues, they have all kinds of, you know, reserve issues and so forth and so on. So they expect to be more volatile. But I would expect to see precious metals take a pretty good spike here if the gold price maintains, you know, above, say, $1,700. And today it's around, as we mentioned, 808 right now as I look at the screen. So,
you know, it's a good point in terms of that. How I view that as well is, if one is looking to purchase life insurance, you purchase a life insurance policy rather than buying shares of a life insurance company. And so this is how I differentiate between the two asset classes. One's bullion and one is the stock of the company that creates bullion. Yeah. You could also look at it that way too, in terms of if gold is money, and then this mining company is the printing press because it mines gold. However, to your point, there's many risks involved with it. And going back to what Ray Dalio said, in terms of there'll be an asset class or asset classes in which people are just going to swiftly move their money into. What if it's gold? What if it's gold mining companies? So that's why an allocation is important. Yes, it will be volatile, but don't let that shake you out of your position, because you understand what it represents.
Well, you know, years ago there was there used to be an inverse correlation between gold and equity, and recently it's been a one-way street. They've been highly correlated. I think, you know, again, this goes back to something that Martin Armstrong has said, and I'll probably get it wrong, but our listeners can go and look him up and read what he has to say. But I think, you know, when you move away from the private sector or the public sector into the private sector, that gold is going to be a beneficiary, because that means you're giving up on sovereign debt. And gold is going to be likely a depository. And back to your point about gold versus precious metals, I know in our smart money portfolios, we've actually elected to have gold bullion. We haven't gone the precious metal route, again, for the same reasons that you alluded to. We want to actually own the physical rather than take a chance on management and all the volatility that comes with public share ownership in a fairly volatile market.
Well, that's quite the call, Warren.
Yes, we've covered a lot of ground.
Yeah. Well, it was excellent speaking with you, and enjoy the rest of the week, and we'll talk to you next week.
Okay, sounds good. All the best.
You as well.